That's James's brain giving us feedback.
There we go.
Hi, welcome everybody, ladies, gentlemen, and I suppose there are probably a few distinguished guests out there, so I better acknowledge you all on behalf of the Faculty of Health Science. It gives me great pleasure to introduce James Vickers, Professor of Pathology and Head of the School of Medicine at the University of Tasmania. We're all scientists, or many of us are scientists here, and scientists love their numbers. And I think if you talk about James's numbers, they stack up against the rest of them. In the 19 years, I think it is, sadly for him, that I've known him, he's brought in numerous grants to this institution from the National Health and Medical Research Council, from the Australian Research Council. He's been a C.J. Martin Fellow, an Arnie Wright Fellow, again from the National Health and Medical Research Council. And I'd like to embarrass him as well. The total amount of funds that he's brought to this institution is in excess of $10.5 million. So if everybody goes, that's good. So
I didn't get any of it.
He didn't get any of it. He basically rode on other people's coattails, but no, he didn't. He's co-authored 99 scientific papers, which is a funny number to be stuck on, because if you ask Don Bradman, well, you can't ask Don Bradman really, because it's no longer around. But I can guarantee you that James will not be stuck on 99. For the rest of his career. Most of these papers have centred on the ageing brain, dementia, or bad ageing brain, and various pathologies associated with the human, the most important organ, the most exciting organ that I think we have, which is our brain. We think at the University of Tasmania that his work is exceptional. Other people do as well. No less than 2,500 times has his work been cited over the last 10 to 20 years, which is pretty impressive. During that time, he's also managed to supervise a dozen or so graduate research students and mentor dozens others and mentor several of his colleagues, even some of his older colleagues, as in me. He's received numerous honours. He was given a DSC, which is one of the highest honours a university can bestow upon one of its graduates, in 2005. In 2003, at the age, I think, very young age, at that. We'll say he was 38. He was made a professor of pathology, one of the youngest professors ever appointed at this institution. But in 2008, himself and Professor Andrew Robinson from the School of Nursing established the Wiking Dementia Teaching and Research Institute, or the Wiking Institute as everybody calls it. And that's probably really where I should leave you in James's capable hands to talk about the Healthy Brain Aging Project and various other really interesting work that he and his colleagues down at the Menzies and Wiking Institute have been carrying out. In keeping, however, with good old-fashioned Tasmanian parochialism, I do have to say that James is born and bred in Launceston. Professor James Vickers.
I dare say that was longer and probably better than the presentation that I'm going to give. So this is the general theme, I guess, of the talk that I'm going to do tonight. Hopefully we'll leave some time at the end to have some discussion, questions and answers, and so forth, because I'm sure people have heard a lot about this essential question. Are there things that we can be doing in our lives now to try and protect our brains from dementias as well as other nasty ageing-related neurodegenerative disorders? I'm going to start off talking about dementia, and particularly the major cause of dementia, which is Alzheimer's disease, again, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. Then I'm going to sort of segue into talking about brain plasticity, some of our own work, but also some of these key discoveries that have occurred over the last 10 or 15 years. And then I'm going to come back towards the end and I guess critically examine what are the possibilities that we've got to try and prevent ourselves or from developing these kinds of diseases, or at least reduce our risk, as well as talk a little bit about one of the studies that we're involved with in the Wiking Dementia Research and Education Centre that in fact involves very critically some investigators up here in Launceston. And this is the Healthy Brain Project. So thank you all for coming. I'm actually particularly interested, before I get going though, is there anyone here tonight who's actually part of the Healthy Brain Project? Anybody? A couple at the front there? Great. So hopefully by the end of the talk we may well recruit some other people to be part of this Tasmanian study. So Alzheimer's disease is a significant health, social and economic problem for countries such as Australia and really worldwide. Currently around about 1% of our population suffers from Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, again, is not the only thing that will cause ageing-related dementia, but it is the major cause. And this is the disease I'll spend most of my time talking about. It's what we refer to as being degenerative and progressive. This is a normal brain, a dead person, but otherwise normal-looking brain. This is the brain from somebody who had Alzheimer's disease. When I show this slide to medical students and ask what the difference between this brain and this brain is, some of the cheeky ones would suggest that, in fact, this one's missing a cerebellum, brainstem and spinal cord. It's just been taken off. But hopefully you'll see a critical element of the differences between an otherwise healthy brain and somebody with Alzheimer's disease is this frank shrinkage or atrophy of the brain. So we know that there are this constellation of pathological changes that characterise Alzheimer's disease. We know also that it is progressive, that once you get Alzheimer's disease, you are not going to get better, you're only going to get worse. Some people get worse very quickly, over a year, 18 months. Some other people, it can linger on for a number of years. The good news about Alzheimer's disease, though, in terms of an ageing-related condition, is that it is a disease. It's not just a natural consequence of ageing. Like other diseases, there are these pathological features that characterise the condition. I'm not going to go into an enormous amount of detail about this. This is really actually also why this condition gets its name Alzheimer's disease, because Sir Lois Alzheimer was the first person to describe these specific pathological features. These consist of amyloid plaques, which are extracellular deposits of a protein known as beta amyloid or A beta, and within neurons, a collection of filamentous proteins or fibrils that form these tangle-like structures, and they're referred to as neurofibrillary tangles. So the extracellular plaques and intracellular tangles are examples of these very specific pathological features, as well as that atrophy of or shrinkage of the brain. Doesn't show up so well here, but here's one of our sort of modern imaging methods that we can use to look at these pathological changes in brain sections from people who have had this condition, and in sort of this purpley blue colour is an amyloid plaque. These red structures here are abnormal nerve fibres called dystrophic neurites, which occur associated with the plaque and may well be linked with the development of tangles. And around it in green are the axons. One thing you'll note, there's lots of reasonably normal looking axons around the plaque. Very few inside the plaque. Alzheimer's disease is also a quintessentially human condition in many ways, because its site of attack is the cerebral cortex and particularly the neocortex. It's very gradual and insidious in its progression, and they basically over time develop these plaques and these tangles, and they reach a certain threshold and then you start to develop the clinical features of Alzheimer's disease. This is just a figure showing the kind of hotter areas for the development of these neurofibrillary tangles and the side view of the brain. And here we can see there's lots of tangles in the temporal lobe and quite a lot of tangles in the association areas of the neocortex. In the primary visual, motor and sensory regions, there's much fewer tangles. So again, this is the particularly nastiness of the disease, is that this pathology occurs in the most evolved parts of the brain, in those parts of the neocortex, whose job it is to give us all of our higher functions, human functions, our personality, cognitive capacity, and so forth. A little slide here showing what we think about what happens in terms of the progression of the disease, and I mentioned this already. We think that there's, in fact, a rather lengthy preclinical phase of the disease where it's not obvious that somebody has a condition such as Alzheimer's disease. And very early on in this condition, you see the deposition of plaques, and then following that, the tangles start to occur, and you have frank damage to the neurons and their connections, the synapses. And this reaches the threshold after which you start to see the overt symptoms, and depending on what country you're in or what state even, you may get a good diagnosis or not. So we think that, in fact, this lengthy preclinical stage of this disease, maybe as long as 5 years, maybe even 10 years, where these plaques, for example, are building up inside our brain, the tangles start to form, they get to a certain density, neurons start to die, and then you get the overt features of the disease. This is actually particular, this all sounds like bad news, but this in particular is good news because it tells us two things. One, it's a disease. So like other diseases, there should be points of intervention here that if somebody clever enough in a lab somewhere can come up with a drug that interferes with that, then you may well stop the progression of the disease. The other is that there is this lengthy preclinical phase of the condition. So if we can get better at identifying this preclinical phase, and there are excellent researchers here at the up in Launceston School of Psychology, such as Matthew Summers and his colleagues, who are trying to come up, for example, with neuropsychological indicators of this preclinical phase, or at least those people at risk of developing the clinical features of Alzheimer's disease. Because this is where you want to come in with a drug. It is actually too late to come in with a drug when somebody's got established Alzheimer's disease. Those nerve cells have died, their long projections that interconnect up different parts of the brain have gone, and there is really no way, I guess, of compensating for that kind of pathology. So that's as much biology as I'm probably going to tell you in terms of Alzheimer's disease. I'll come back to telling you a little bit more biology about the plasticity of the brain, but I thought I'd spend a few slides talking about the extent of the problem of dementia. And I think, again, this kind of audience, if you come along tonight, you're likely to be aware that the problem of dementia is significant now, and in the future is going to be massive. So if you look in Australia, for example, with the baby boomers now coming up to the official retirement age, there's about 250,000 or so people in Australia alone who have got overt dementia. With the ageing of the population and the changing in our demographics, people living to longer lives, as well as the movement of the baby boomer generation through our demography, we're going to see a big increase in the number of people who are older. And linked into that is a big increase in the number of people who are going to have dementia. By 2030, there'll be about 590,000. They estimate, or Access Economics estimates, that by the middle of the century, well over a million people in Australia with dementia. These are obviously relatively frightening numbers, and there are obvious significant health, social and economic consequences of all of this. And this comes back to the age-relatedness of dementia and conditions such as Alzheimer's disease. When you're in your 60s, your chance of developing Alzheimer's disease or dementia is actually fairly low, in the low percentage, somewhere between 2 and 5%. But as you get older, your relative risk of developing this disease goes up geomatically, in the sense that it magnifies. So by the time into your mid-80s, about 25% of people have dementia. And in fact, if we go looking for those pathological brain signs, pretty much everybody else in that age group has the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease. So in 2010, we've got about 75,000 new cases of dementia. 2030, 187,000 new cases. And 2050, it's getting up there to the population of Tasmania in terms of numbers of new cases of people with dementia. In terms of causes of death, and my good colleague Andrew Robinson is a proponent of this idea that in fact we should be very carefully thinking about conditions such as Alzheimer's disease as being palliative in nature. No one actually gets better from Alzheimer's disease. People think that you actually don't die from Alzheimer's disease, but in fact you do. There may well be other factors that come into the equation, or it might be a respiratory disease that shuffles you off. But physicians are now getting much more savvy about describing the proximate cause of death. And this is reflected in statistics from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. By far and away, ischemic heart disease is still the number one killer if you talk about individual causes of disease. But interestingly, despite the increase in older people and the numbers in our population, those figures are getting down, which actually tells an interesting public health story. So we're getting better at managing people with ischemic heart disease, heart failure, and so forth. As a consequence of that, we're actually seeing increases in the rates of other causes of death. Strokes is obviously fairly high, and here is dementia, which in 2008 was ranked number 3. If you only go back a few years, you'll find that dementia was ranked number 7 and so forth. So again, there's this escalating number of people living with dementia and dying with dementia. Quickly, I guess a little look at Tasmanian demographics tells this story as well too, and these are slides from a wonderful demographer, Natalie Jackson. She describes the proportion of the population at various ages, males and females, back in 1971, when about 8% of the population was over the age of 65. Proportionally, you can see it's a pyramidal sort of pyramid-shaped graph. Relatively speaking, there are lots of younger people and not so many older people. You compare that to what we're going to be looking at in just a few years. Here's the baby boomer generation, and you can see here that proportionately they take up a fairly significant part of the Tasmanian population. Also proportionately, there's going to be much more older people, about 20% of the population over the age of 65. With declining birth rates and funny patterns of immigration into the state, you can also see that there's proportionately fewer young people as well too. So there's good and bad news in this, of course. Of course, this group, as it moves through and we're managing various chronic conditions and so forth, they're going to be exposed to an incurable disease such as dementia and Alzheimer's disease and so forth. But the other good news is that this group down here is likely not to experience large rates of unemployment. So, in fact, as this group moves through the population, and it may well be that they're all working in nursing homes, but we'll see how that goes. So again, some little sort of facts and figures. This is a little bit outdated. This is the last time somebody seriously looked at this in Australia, was Access Economics, about really what can we do about dementia. We don't actually have any drugs that can actually treat the underlying pathology of the condition. You know, what is it that we can do to maybe help stem the numbers and the associated costs? And they worked out then, in 2004, that if you could delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease by 5 months, you'd actually save $1 billion by 2020 and $6.5 billion by 2040. Again, just related to the escalation of the numbers of people with dementia. So even a modest delay in the onset of Alzheimer's disease can have significant savings. If you can delay it by 5 years, then the savings are much more significant. We look worldwide, and this is just a study actually out just quite recently in September of this year. It's been estimated that worldwide the cost of dementia in 2010 was $604 billion. Now, most of that is actually in developed countries, and most of that is in residential aged care facilities and nursing homes. That's what it's like now. Now, you consider, well, okay, dementia is a bad enough problem in developed countries such as Australia, America, UK and so forth. There are countries that have had very little problems with dementia that are on their way up. China, India and so forth. They're not used to having large numbers of older people. Now they're similarly going to be highly challenged by this growing number of people moving through their, again, moving through their demography. And in particular places like China with the one baby scenario, there's going to be this disproportionate large number of older people, their parents, and very few people underneath that to provide a financial, economic and support base to look after them. So all of this is going to escalate significantly. If dementia care was a country, in 2010 it'd be the 18th largest economy. Here's the worldwide figures, 35.5 million sufferers last year, 65 and a bit in 2030, and well over 100 million by 2050. So it's a big problem. We don't have any drugs to treat it. It is an area of concentrated research effort by all of the large pharmaceutical companies to try and come up with a drug that might attack the plaques or attack the tangles and so forth. Now, I'm sure there's an iota of altruism behind that, but essentially they're also interested in that equation because these are multi-billion-dollar drugs if anybody can crack it. And I guess that's the hope. Maybe it's the large pharmaceutical companies that will come up with something, or maybe it's one of the thousands of people working in laboratories around the world who will come up with a lucky combination and come up with some way of treating this terrible set of diseases. In the absence of this, we've got this problem of dealing with a disease that is progressive and degenerative, so it's unrelenting and it will kill you. So what do we do? This actually leads, I guess, now to be thinking about other strategies. Is there something that we can be doing when we're younger? Is there some modifiable risk factor that we can address that may reduce our risk, or even if we are at high risk, delay the onset of this condition? So again, it's rather an ageing-related condition. If you could delay something like Alzheimer's disease for months or years or something in that sort of scale, it may well be that something else will shuffle you off, so, such that the dementia isn't the significant health problem that it will be. So this gets on to now to talking about structural plasticity of neurons. So there's an idea out there that maybe there is something that we can boost the inherent qualities of nerve cells, their ability to change or their ability to resist disease and so forth, to try and mitigate the effects of these degenerative brain conditions. And I guess I'm going to focus more on structural plasticity. And what I mean by structural plasticity is either new nerve cells, stem cells, all that sort of stuff, or those nerve cells that are there, do they have some sort of capacity to change their shapes, their processes, which are the dendrites, which receive information from other nerve cells, or their long axons, which then communicate information out to other nerve cells? Can these in any way change their shape, orientation, geometry, or sprout, or re-innovate, or do something like that to increase structural plasticity in the brain? Clearly, we all know that structural plasticity of neurons has to have an important role in brain development. We had the head of the School of Education here earlier, but I think he might have left. But my point often is that when you actually think about education, for example, and the fact that we send our children to school now for hopefully for as long as 12 years, is actually this is all about neuroscience in action. Because what we're trying to do through development is tap into this natural plasticity or capacity of nerve cells to change their relationship, their shapes and their relationships with each other, such that over time we become educated. Everybody accepts this notion in the sense that through development there's a lot of stuff going on inside our brains as we mature. What up until quite recently has been quite controversial, I suppose, and in fact significantly poo-pooed, is the capacity in adulthood and older age for the structural plasticity of neurons to continue. And obviously this has got relevance not only to neurodegenerative diseases, which I'm going to talk about mostly, but other forms of acquired brain injury, traumatic brain injury, strokes, spinal cord injury and so forth, where we might want to try and recreate or reroute the nervous system to overcome a site of damage. Hopefully you can see it down here. I might turn this... Would people mind if I turn the lights down just a little bit more? Actually, I might turn... Yeah, that'll work. Just very quickly, a little introduction to development of neurons. Here again is a nerve cell. Here is its short dendrites, which again receive information from other nerve cells. They give rise to axons, which can be fairly short or really long, in the case of the say from the spinal cord to the tips of your toes, it's going to be a metre or so. This very long axon which projects out to various targets, and at the end of that there's usually synapses. For nerve cells to grow and make their connections, they make these specialised structures called growth cones, and they sit at the ends of the axons, and you can see one in this little movie here. These are nerve cells grown in culture by my colleagues in our laboratory. Here's one of these axons, and you can see over time, this is a movie over a few hours, this very dynamic end of the axon, which is the growth cone. So it's like a hand with lots of fingers, and it's doing this sort of thing. This is an incredibly important structure for development, because basically, if this is the axon and this is the growth cone helps guide the axon to where it needs to be. And it does that by sensing the local environment, various growth factors, barriers and whatnot, and then making their way around to make an appropriate connection with another nerve cell. So a growth cone kind of sits there doing this for some time, sensing the environment, and might decide to go this direction or that direction, or in fact it's not going the right way and it'll go back. Through the development of the brain, nerve cells are sort of competing for connections. So there's a bit of neural Darwinism that goes on. And those nerve cells that make a good connection or appropriate connection live, and in fact those nerve cells that don't make a good connection actually die off. One of the key people who discovered this wonderful capacity of neurons to grow, the growth cone, how it then goes on to form various structures of the brain, was a very famous Spanish neuroscientist, the godfather of neuroscience, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who was very active around the beginning of the last century. and again did all this fundamental work on the nervous system. As part of that, he also did some work around looking at the capacity of the nerve cells to regenerate or recapitulate those developmental patterns after they've been damaged. And he became very pessimistic about this. And you can probably have read his quote up here, which essentially says that once nerve cells have formed their connections, if something happens to them, it's bad luck. You've lost the neuron, it has little capacity to regenerate, the nervous system becomes fixed or immutable as you go through those early stages of development. However, like a lot of things in science, there's this fantastic capacity to surprise you when these sorts of paradigms become, I guess, overturned. And this new, I guess, understanding of the plasticity of the brain and its capacity to change in adulthood and old age is really an entirely new field. It would say probably about 15 or so years. And then there's been this great escalation of a number of biological studies that have told us very fundamental things about the plasticity of the nervous system. And I'm just going to walk you through some examples of it. The first one is that the mature brain has this capacity to make new nerve cells. Again, the dogma used to be that the nerve cells you were born with are the only ones you're going to have. They're going to make connections. Those that make connections will live. Those that don't make connections die. Otherwise, you need to look after them for several decades because you're not going to get any more. However, when they started to develop techniques to look into this a little bit more closely, they found that in certain parts of the brain, not all over the brain, but in very specific parts of the brain, there were reservoirs of what we refer to as neural stem cells. And these neural stem cells are hopefully active in all of us here tonight, are in the process of making new, what we call progenitor cells, which is this fellow here. Now this progenitor cell, depending on what signals it gets, can turn into a nerve cell, so that overturns the dogma that in fact you don't make new nerve cells in the adult brain. Or it can make these support cells called glial cells, oligodendrocytes and astrocytes. The way they determined that is they used a what we refer to as a thymidine analog. So it's an analog for one of the nucleotides that makes up DNA. Basically, it's a marker for cells that undergo division. And it's called, the short version is BRDU, or bromodeoxyuridine. And they could give this, for example, to experimental animals, rats and mice and so forth, peripherally or even in their food. And then this marker would be taken up by those cells that undergo division. And then you could go in and use histological techniques, such as this little, and this little green dot down here is the nucleus of one of these cells that have undergone division. So it's a marker of cells that have undergone division. And that's indeed how they discovered that, in fact, you could make new nerve cells. Interestingly, they turned out to be only present, these neural stem cells making new nerve cells, to be only two, really a couple of sites. And one of them was the hippocampus, and a particular part of the hippocampus called the dentate gyrus. And this is continually making glial cells or support cells as well as neurons. As usual, when people discover these things in mice and rats, they thought, oh, well, that's all very interesting. Mice and rats, though, aren't human beings. Then there was this wonderful and pivotal study where a very generous group of people who, in fact, had cancer and, in fact, were going to die reasonably soon, agreed to donate their brains for study. And the reason why these people were research gold, if you like, is that they had received BRDU for other studies trying to track the growth rates of the cancers that they had. So they had been injected with BRDU to measure, for example, the development of cancerous cells in the thyroid and so forth. That drug, if you like, or that chemical can get into the brain, and so it would also label up those cells that would be undergoing cell division in the brain. And again, these wonderful people donated their brains after death, and they basically found the same, this is this marker for BRDU here, they found the same, in the same region of the brain, in the hippocampus, there were these cells undergoing constant renewal, and that they could go on to make new nerve cells. So what was happening in rats and mice was the same as what was happening in human beings, in adults and older human beings, I should add. So we're able now to, I guess, rather definitively conclude that in certain parts of your brain you have this capacity to have neural stem cells, they will make new neurons. They can form different types of neurons, excitatory and inhibitory neurons, in terms of their effects on other nerve cells and neurotransmitters that they contain. We clearly actually still have, even though this is a 10 or 15 year old literature now, we clearly still have no idea what actual function this actually has. Why do we need a renewal of these cells in this particular part of the brain? We know again from many of those animal studies that the hippocampus has a very important role in memory. Not in long-term memory or remembering things past, but in the process of making new memories. So perhaps there needs to be a renewal of the circuitry so that you retain this capacity to make new neurons. We know there are all sorts of things that you can do to manipulate the generation of these new nerve cells. Stress, for example, is a good deregulator of neural stem cells, so you'll have fewer stem cells, and there are these other things that will increase it. Exercise, for example, it's controversial, but at least in experimental models of stroke, there seems to be a generation of these new nerve cells. Very interestingly, and potentially revolutionary in terms of what our understanding of psychiatric conditions, some drugs which we used to think will probably still have an effect on particular neurotransmitters such as the serotonin system, and you know, many of you might know that antidepressant medications, many of them are based on inhibiting serotonin reuptake mechanisms, the idea to boost the amount of serotonin. They also work on these neural stem cells to increase neuronal production. Similarly, ECT, which is, you know, obviously not a pleasant thing to undergo, but can be to some degree ameliorative in terms of depression, also boosts the production of these new cells. So again, it may well have, all of this new information will have, may have implications for psychiatric conditions. So that's new stem cells. This other one is actually, this other area which turned out to be quite exciting was what plasticity that in fact that the nerve cells that you already had to change and change their shapes and morphology and so forth. And again, the dogma was a nerve cell formed its geometry, its dendrites and axons, and then they were fixed in place. And now that seems to be overturned as well too. Just a quick, again, primer on nerve cells and their biology. Here again is a nerve cell. There's the cell body, the dendrites, again, the long axon, which goes down to terminals. Axon potentials are generated up here, and the signal is propagated down the axon, and at the terminals they release neurotransmitters onto the next set of dendrites and the next nerve cell and so forth. When you look in the neocortex in particular, so that again that most evolutionarily advanced part of our nervous system, many of the neurons in the neocortex are also what we refer to as being spiny. I'm not sure how well it projects, but down here, but here's an example of one of these nerve cells. There's its dendrites, and you might see there are these little fine protuberances that we call spines that jut out from the sides of the dendrites. Here at much higher magnification, again, some of these spines. You can see some of them have very narrow necks and sort of bulbous ends, and some other ones are a bit more stubby. Essentially, wherever you find one of these spines is where you'll find the synapses, or the areas of communication between two nerve cells. So down here, here's the axon terminals down here, where the neurotransmitters come, travel down the axon into the terminals, and if the axon is sending a message, then they will release the neurotransmitters and they'll have an effect on receptors that are localized on the ends of these spines. I hope that's clearish. But essentially the view was, until very recently, is that, again, through development you would develop the dendrites and the spines, but the spines would be relatively fixed. Okay, so an axon forms a communication, axon comes in, forms a link with that spine, that's the beginning and the end of it. When they developed a capacity to start to image these spines, either in neurons grown in cell culture or more recently with methods known as two-photon microscopy, which we've now established down in Hobart and the Menzies Research Institute, you start to develop this capacity to actually see these dendrites and spines in living neurons. And so you can make little movies of those dendrites and spines and neurons and axons over time. And hopefully while I'm talking, you may well have recognized that here we have a dendrite that would come off a cell body that might be over there. Here are the spines that come off that dendrite. Another example here. And these will be movies over a number of minutes or hours and so forth. And you may well have already picked up that some of these spines aren't doing very much. Maybe they're quivering around a little bit. But other ones are actually changing their geometry quite significantly. Here's a good example here, a relatively stable spine. And there's a spine that's sort of coming out, coming back in. And there's lots of examples here. And this is essentially, I mean, I've been around neurosciences a while now, but I could legitimately say that when these findings came along, this freaked out a whole bunch of neuroscientists all around the world. Because these are observations that you can actually see in the mature nervous system. Not only is it kind of, like, you know, maybe look pretty down the microscope, and that was all well and good, and there were advanced microscope techniques, wonderful, but what this was actually telling us is that those synaptic relationships, those connections between nerve cells, had the capacity to keep changing. That they didn't just happen during development. In those 12 years of schooling, and maybe you went to uni, maybe a little bit more, a few more connections being made, that wasn't the end of it. That some connections remain stable, but many others are actually changing all the time and continue to change. So enormously exciting. We know a bit more about this, because again, this is a literature that is literally about 10 years old, that some of these synapses are quite stable in the neocortex. Some of them are quite plastic or subject to change. How they're all regulated, we have absolutely no idea. And again, these are really interesting biological questions that a number of people are working on. What we suspect, although we don't know, is that some of this has got something to do with long-term memory circuits in the neocortex. It's probably got a lot to do with lots of other things as well too. But people have been wondering for a while, for argument's sake, if you happen to remember this lecture next week or even a couple of hours from now, what has actually happened in your brain or changed in your brain for those connections between nerve cells to reflect that memory. And we think that maybe it's in this regulation of dynamic and plastic spines that might underlie this capacity. It also opens up new vistas, potentially again, into other conditions, psychiatric conditions such as schizophrenia. So now people are interested in looking at conditions such as schizophrenia, which really has it may well have its seeds in early life, but certainly many people here would know that schizophrenia becomes overt in late adolescence and early adulthood. And maybe, again, it's about a regulation of this plasticity. And people have looked into the brains of unfortunate people with schizophrenics and have consistently found now that they have fewer spines on these neurons in the neocortex. So, again, maybe this is telling us something about what's changing, or maybe a nasty face of the plasticity of the brain. So here's some examples. I've talked about some examples of what happens in normal brain. What happens to neurons following, say, for example, various forms of brain injury? And I guess this is where our laboratory comes into the equation, because this is where we're also starting to look at some of those dynamic aspects of neurons and how they work and their structural plasticity. After various kinds of injury, are we making new nerve cells? What capacity do damaged axons have to regenerate and sprout? Obviously very important if you've got a spinal cord injury, for argument's sake. And are there any interesting changes in those dendrites, spines, and so forth? And there's a lot of studies that we're up to. I'll give a quick example of a few of these. One of the things that we do in our laboratory is that we use a combination of different kinds of models. Some of those models involve growing nerve cells in culture. This is an example of nerve cells that we've grown from either it could be rats or mice. They're grown in culture for a number of weeks. They form up these clumps of cells with these axons that come out and connect up with other nerve cells. And these are just some markers that show the relative maturity that you can get of these nerve cells grown in culture for a number of weeks. A few people in the laboratory have spent some time doing interesting things with this cell culture model. Some of them have been cutting those axons and trying to see what happens to those cut axons after injury. Do those cut axons have a capacity to regenerate? If you remember Cahill was very pessimistic about this idea, and in fact really the whole field is deeply pessimistic about the idea of damaged axons having any capacity to regenerate. Not sure how well you can see that. But essentially this is, again, nerve cells grown in culture. Here we've made an injury, which was a sort of a structural injury. There are a whole bunch of axons in this side and some axons on that side. And one of the discoveries that we had a number of years ago, championed largely by my excellent colleague, Dr. Tracy Dixon, as well as a number of other people in the laboratory, was to determine that, in fact, yes, damaged axons do, many damaged axons do, in fact, attempt regeneration. So again, these are all cut axons. You can see one guy down here who's trying to sprout back in this direction. There's another one there that sort of shoots across over there. So again, these are time-lapse movies over a number of minutes. And we got very excited about this because we thought, well, you know, there was Cahill, you know, godfather of neuroscience, Nobel Prize winner, you know, everybody recognises him as a pivotal figure in neuroscience, and he got it wrong, you know, so nya nya nya. Well, in fact, we explored this a little bit further, and in fact, probably Cahill was completely right about damaged axons. The capacity of these damaged axons to mount an appropriate regenerative response is actually turns out to be fairly limited. And another talented PhD student in the laboratory, Kathy Lizard, spent some time looking into this. And essentially what she found, that again, this is a picture, high-powered micrograph of an axon in development. There's the axon, there's the end of this growth cone structure, which again looks like a hand with lots of little fine fingers. When you look at axons after they're damaged and trying to regenerate, they don't look like this. They end up looking sort of clubby like this, and maybe with a few protuberances out. They do still sprout and so forth, but they don't do it in a guided and a coordinated fashion as what you see during normal development. In fact, most sprouting, there is actually quite a lot of sprouting that you can see after various kinds of injury, be it experimental or in human brains, but most of it is fairly localized. Those neurons have very little capacity to send out long axons that can reconnect with other nerve cells in a useful way, probably because they don't form these appropriate developmental growth cone-like structures. So that was a bit disappointing, but again, it told us a lot about the intrinsic capacity or lack of capacity of neurons to attempt regeneration. So they do demonstrate an attempt. Maybe in the future we can look at ways of trying to guide that more appropriately or trying to recapitulate this developmental growth cone, but it's going to take a lot of work to overcome this intrinsic limitation. Where the field has moved really more closely, and us as well, is maybe our chances of regenerating damaged axons is going to be limited, but maybe there are things that we can do with the undamaged neurons that are in the area or even at a distance that are in terms of stimulating their sprouting to form more functional connections. And we refer to this as collateral sprouting. And in the cartoon down here, here's our nerve cell body with the dendrites, a couple of axons that come in and form synapses. This one gets damaged in some way. Again, we're pessimistic about the capacity to regenerate this connection. But it may well be that the undamaged axon, the undamaged neuron, can undergo this adaptive sprouting and so forth. So we're doing various studies on that currently. There are other aspects, though, of plasticity that are worth investigating. For example, I mentioned the generation of neural stem cells, and other dendritic changes and so forth. And again, this is very quickly, we're starting to run out of time, but there's another model that we use a lot which involves a fine lesion of the neocortex in experimental animals such as rats and mice, simply really putting in a fine gauge needle into the brain and taking it out, sewing the animal up, and off we go. And we've actually shown in this model too, not unsurprisingly, if you put a needle into the brain, you make a hole. But the brain, if you look at the time after injury, there actually is this capacity of the brain to undergo a healing process. All sorts of cells are mobilised. We've actually just published a paper actually looking at neural stem cells. The question was, do you make neural stem cells after injury? The answer is you do. That's on the next slide, but I'll just tell you what the result was. But they don't make neurons. They make those support cells, those glial cells. Now, it may well be that injuries to other parts of the brain might promote neurogenesis or the generation of new nerve cells, but it doesn't seem that this neural stem cell reservoir is targeted so much at replacing damaged or lost nerve cells in the mature brain. What we did find, though, again, was work done in Kathy Blizzard's thesis, is that when we started to look at this idea, well, maybe damaged things have very little capacity to restore themselves. Maybe we need to be looking at nerve cells that are undamaged and whether they have a capacity for compensatory plasticity or compensatory changes. What she did, here's a cut through a rat brain. This is the kind of lesion that she made, again, with that fine gauge needle. She spent a bit of time looking at directly around the site of damage, but then she starts to look at either side of the injury site, and this is where it got particularly interesting. And she was able to take pictures of these nerve cells and their dendrites and look at what we call the polarity or the direction that these nerve cells were going. To cut a long story short, what she found essentially was that these nerve cells, the ones that weren't damaged, actually had a capacity to change their shape. So they actually pulled in their dendrites in certain directions and extended them in others. And the cut and thrust of that is they actually extended their dendrites away from the site of injury and towards uninjured brain. So this was really probably the first time anyone's described these wholesale changes in neurons inside a mature brain in terms of a reaction to injury. She just published this in a journal called Cerebral Cortex. So this, to us, is actually potentially exciting and speaks to that capacity of, if we are looking at damaged nervous systems, maybe the damaged bits we can't save, but maybe we can encourage the other bits to adapt and reroute and reconnect elsewhere. I'll skip over that. Now, I don't know if that'll show. Now, this is now back to Alzheimer's disease. So this is a movie that of some of the results that we can get with that two-photo microscope that I've described before. This is an animal that has been genetically engineered, so it's got a fluorescent protein inside its nerve cells, and that's that green stuff, so all those are individual nerve cells and their dendrites. And then this has been crossed to an animal that contains a familial Alzheimer's disease gene that makes it form those plaques that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. So that blue stuff there is the plaques. And so there are guys in the lab who are looking about how these plaques can affect nerve cells, both directly and also at a distance from the injury site. So it gets back now to trying to, now we know a bit more about the plasticity of the brain. How, in any way, does that translate into something that we can do about modifying our risk of dementia? And I'm just going to give you, a bit of a summary of the state of the art. And there was this rather pessimistic report that came out of the National Institute of Health just this year that looked at the evidence for a number of these potentially modifiable risk factors. And you really can't read the paper almost once a week. There's a story on how red wine protects you, or aluminium pots makes it worse, or, you know, jogging is bad but walking is good, etc., etc., etc. I guess at the moment where we're at is that there are many interesting studies. Many of these are retrospective. Sometimes it's difficult to understand how some people classify dementia and other people classify it a different way, etc., etc. So the summary at the moment is that the level of evidence supporting much of this is actually fairly low. So nutritional supplements, social economic factors, toxins, environmental exposures, really it's very hard to say something definitive about any of those. Here are some ones that are of interest. Certainly diabetes may turn out to be a major negative risk factor. Certainly it seems hypertension is a negative risk factor. So good vascular health is likely to be important if you want to look at something to try and prevent dementia. People have also looked at cognitive training and its potential for mitigating your risk of developing age-related cognitive decline and so forth. A lot of this started at the front end, which is basically, if we did cognitive training intensively, is that going to make us better cognitively or protect us from dementia? And perhaps the most famous study in this area has been the ACTIVE study. And again, you can read about the details here. Essentially what they found, they look really at three types of interventions: cognitive training around memory, around reasoning, or things around speed of processing, using more or less everyday tasks that tap into these, but done in a sort of a training regime, if you like. What they found, there's been a number of papers on this study so far, is that, in fact, if you do any one of those individually, yes, you'll get better at that task. Generally speaking, though, one doesn't translate into the other. So if you're involved in memory training, doesn't make you better at reasoning and speed and so forth. What they have just published is that maybe there is a positive effect on something that's kind of a little bit sort of slippery to define, but activities, self-recorded activities of daily living. So it would seem that all groups that have been involved in this sort of cognitive training didn't deteriorate as much as the control group in terms of that self-reported activities of daily living. So maybe it has a generalizable effect, but pretty much we think that if you do lots of single domain kind of cognitive training, yes, you'll get very good at these, but it may not help you in a sort of holistic or general way. There was another interesting study just published again this year on looking at brain training, particularly those computer games, Nintendo, Wii type things, all those online games that help train your brain and so forth. And they put lots of people through this. It was an online study done in largely in the UK. Most people around the age of 40. There's a criticism over here where the people had enough training sessions to make a difference. But essentially, a number of these tests, a number of these training things sort of focus on individual areas of cognitive function. And yes, if you do these sorts of tests intensively, you will get better at them. But in a sense, they did not generalize into other areas. So again, if you did lots of training around memory, didn't mean you got better at planning, didn't mean you got better visuospatial skills, and so forth. So again, this was sort of at the pessimistic end of whether there are things that we can do, keeping our brains sort of active and so forth, about helping our general cognitive health. But it's important to remember most of these have been very focused kinds of cognitive training tasks. This is where it gets a bit interesting, and you take something, for example, such as work, people working, and we're all going to be working longer apparently soon as well too, so that'll be something else to think about. So there's a lower dementia risk that is linked, has been linked to the complexity of work that involves processing data of various kinds and also interacting with people. This is kind of a famous study that came out of Sweden. However, the longer you work, then the less your cognitive performance is, and which I think we should tell the university this actually sometime as well too. I don't know, they probably won't care. And conversely, actually, again, really interesting study, but it needs more follow-up. People who have a late retirement age have an associated lower risk of developing dementia. So this says to us probably it's not really about unitary tasks or individual domains. Doing some task over and over and over again probably is unlikely to have a beneficial effect. But if we're involved in complex mental stimulation, probably with a social angle, then this may well do our brains a bit of good. So it's the old use it or lose it idea. So we know reasonably certain about some negative risk factors for developing dementia. Getting old is obviously one of them. Poor vascular health seems to be a fairly clear negative factor. A family history as well too can be unhelpful. A family history of resistance to dementia, though, could be positive, on the positive side. And we also know that education at a younger age, the more education you have at a younger age, the less your chance when you get older of developing dementia at an older age. So this gets back to this idea of use it or lose it. Is this thing about being mentally active might build up some kind of reserve in our brain, might tap into those dimensions of structural plasticity, new nerve cells, dendrites changing their shapes, spines being dynamic, all that sort of stuff to resist disease. Here I think actually is the most critical study, and this was actually just published this year. This is the ECLIPSE study, a very powerful study, involved a large number of participants. In fact, it was three longitudinal studies that went on through Europe, and they sort of combined them so that the whole thing would have greater statistical power. The ECLIPSE study, longitudinal studies, for a number of areas of health, but one of the areas of health they were interested in was the risk of dementia. And about half of the group, quite a large number of the group were again very generous and donated their brains at death, and by the time they came to death about 57% of the group were actually demented. What they found basically with this group is the longer years in education in a dose response kind of way led to a reduced risk of developing dementia. Most of this focused on years 1 to 12. So the more years of education you had when you were younger, the less chance you had of developing dementia. What turned out to be, though, incredibly surprising is that when they started looking at brain pathology, well, it didn't have its expression through the amount of brain pathology that you had, the atrophy, the tangles, the plaques. The education effect worked somewhat independently of how much pathological load that you had. That's one of the final slides around here. This is where they classified these brains into either having moderate severe pathology, like cortical atrophy, mild pathology, or no pathology. So if you just look at this moderate severe group, it's really the same here for plaques as well too. But if you've had very little education, then you had a very high risk of having, and you had lots of pathology, you had a very high risk of actually being demented. If you had more education, but the same amount of pathology, your risk of being demented at death was much less. And so this is really an interesting concept, which says maybe there is something about education building up cognitive reserve or a capacity of our brains to resist the pathology. We can't do anything about the pathology. It's a disease process. It'll come along. It'll wreak its damage on your brain and so forth. But maybe there is something modifiable that we can do that around education that might protect the brain. Which leads to this very final last few slides. It's gone a bit longer than I thought. But just a lot of this kind of data, as well as the things that we were doing in the laboratory on the plasticity of the brain, as well as looking at human brains and transgenic animals and so forth that have Alzheimer's disease pathology, in combination with excellent skilled researchers in neuropsychology, such as Matthew Summers, who I mentioned before, and a number of other collaborators around the country and overseas, led to the development of this project, which really for the first time is going to look at this education question, but not at the early points. What happens if you start to get more of this education, this complex mental stimulation that we think goes on in universities? Maybe it doesn't. Hobart, it would be interesting, we've got people all around the country, so maybe there'll be Hobart long system differences, we don't know. But the idea with a university education, which is a little bit different to University of Third Age, not to be rude about University of Third Age, but many of those other sort University of Third Age things are rather passive. You go along to a lecture like this one, you hear something, you forget about it later, you know, so what? Whereas you may remember lots about it, but don't be rude about it. But I guess the idea of universities and formally doing units and courses and things like that is that they can be a bit more mentally taxing because they involve assessment. You'll be doing assignments, exams, all those sorts of things. Or if you're doing it at the postgraduate level, you might be doing research, theses, whatever. And there's also obviously a social engagement component as well too, coming out to university, meeting people, and so forth. So the goal of the study is to try and get older Tasmanians, sometimes not that old, mature to older Tasmanians back into university to see if this might help to stimulate neuronal plasticity, cognitive reserve, and help protect your brain from some of these ageing-related conditions. Matthew Summers plays a critical role in this project. Other co-investigators include Andrew Robinson, sitting over there, who's also co-director of the Wicking Dementia Research and Education Centre. Jeff Summers in the School of Psychology in the South, Tracy Dixon, a colleague in the Menzies, Michael Valenzuela, who's got a new book out on brain plasticity and staving off dementia, who's at the University of New South Wales, another psychologist, and Karen Ritchie, who's a Tasmanian but runs a research institute on dementia in France, but is one of the key people who discovered the link between what happens cognitively as you get older and how that might play out into your risk of dementia. So it's really quite a good team of investigators involved. We get people can do all sorts of things at uni. We're not prescriptive. They can do a little. They can do a lot over whatever number of years. As part of this, though, we do a detailed neuropsychological examination, which can take a number of hours. The other interesting thing is we're looking at people between the ages 50 and 70. Now, with the federal government very interested in extending the retirement age, you may well be coming back into university in your 50s, may well help set the scene for your second career and so forth. So it's not completely just for the, it could be just for the study. And clearly also, it's the question that we're investigating. We're not sure what the answer will be, but maybe there is some potential benefit preventing or reducing ageing-related cognitive decline. So there's benefits to participants, there's benefits definitely to the university. Universities should not be for young people. I guess at some levels people think that universities have become training grounds, but I always think that universities are wonderful inventions that are about obtaining and developing new knowledge and so forth. So that's not just for 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. It really should be for everyone. It's also really good if you look at it from the other direction, those 18 and 19-year-olds who come into university. I think it's terrific that they're sharing their tutorial rooms, lecture theatres with older people with a wide range of experiences and so forth. Clearly here is where we're directed, and I refer back to that initial slide, I suppose, the idea that if you can delay Alzheimer's disease or dementia even for a few months, you may well die of something else that's maybe a personal benefit, but you're certainly going to be saving billions in healthcare costs for the community. Some details that you've already got. What we're going to do over time, though, is initially we're going to follow people for 5 years. That really won't be about dementia. That will be just looking at how our cognitive capacity changes through age, through normal aging, and how the university might play into that. We're hoping, funds willing and the participants willing as well, too, that we can actually maintain this cohort over a longer period of time, 10 years, maybe 15 years, because then really we get to the very interesting questions about whether this may or may not play a role in mitigating the risk of developing dementia. And there's great scope for a whole bunch of other sub-projects, but I guess we've been in somewhat of a hurry to get the main project up. But maybe over time we'll be looking at other things, either at the biological end, maybe how the genetics. We know about genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. How do they play a role in how we respond to tertiary education and potentially boosting cognitive reserve, for example? This is an example of the neuropsychological examination that Matthew Summers is leading around the state. So things around memory, short-term memory, long-term memory, language functions, executive functions, and so forth. I should also mention that the study's actually been underway for a year or so, and we're looking obviously to try and recruit people over the next few years if we can. And we think that there may well be a fair bit of interest in this, again, because the baby boomer generation, which is sort of an engaged generation, doesn't want to sit on its hands. Many people in that group may well be thinking about coming back to university and doing something they've always been interested in anyway. So we're hoping to tap into people's interests in that area. Finally, a rather lengthy acknowledgement slide. Again, I've pointed out Andrew. There's Andrew also over there, who's the co-director of the Wickham Dementia Research Education Centre, a very close colleague in the biological end of what we've been doing in Hobart is Dr Tracy Dixon there, who has been leading a lot of those laboratory-based studies on Alzheimer's disease and neuroplasticity, and in particular she's been providing a lot of guidance to Kathy Blizzard, whose studies were those ones around plasticity and so forth. So the last slide, a slide actually from this young fellow here, Stan, using one of our fluorescent microscopes, showing again a couple of these nefarious amyloid plaques inside the brain, and then in green and red markers for nerve cells around them. The bottom line is, well, I'm not sure, but we're in the game also of trying to figure out ways of getting rid of plaques or stopping their damage to nerve cells. We don't know whether that's going to be, on our level, whether it's going to be successful, or in many of those laboratories all around the world, or for those pharmaceutical companies. Hopefully somebody will come up with a magic bullet there. If not, I think the game is on now to try and boost the capacity of all the nerve cells around the plaques to adapt, functionally adapt to the presence of these pathological features, so in fact that we can have more years of useful and happy life before something like dementia comes along and ruins it. Thank you very much.